We are studying the book of Samuel. We're in 1 Samuel. I'm on page 80. And this is a part of Samuel where he's talking, it's focused at length on David. Earlier part was on Saul. Samuel starts with the beginning of the era of the kings. And just a quick arc on David's life. David was a eighth son of a man of Judah who was from a sort of nothing group. He was not very notable. Came from a town called Bethlehem, which was really small. And as the eighth son, he got passed down to him, like all the other sons, the responsibility of keeping sheep. But because he was the last son, then he wound up keeping sheep longer than any of the other sons, because there was no one to replace him. And he lived fairly solitary in his lifetime, and especially his early life. And he developed a personal relationship with the Lord in that process. He was apparently well trained at home about God, and he and God developed a friendship all alone out with the sheep. And he learned to rely on God for things. He was able to deal with things like the attack of wild animals, etc., etc., by the support of the Lord. David has many stories. He talks about the fact that God helped him in times of difficulty. And this solitary style of his and the relationship that he had with God sustained him all the rest of his life. And we all know David wasn't perfect, and he had sin, and he had fairly good-sized sin. But David understood something that very intuitively. We talk about revelation, you know. Revelation is a gift. When we know something about God, it's because he's given it to us. Very smart people often don't get God. And very simple people often get gods in spades. Because God reveals himself to those who seek him. And David understood theology, the study of God. He understood God in many ways better than almost anybody else in the Bible, and especially the Old Testament. He was one of a couple of dozen men and women who had a particularly intimate relationship with the Lord. And one thing David learned in that process is that God does not hold our sins against us if we maintain our relationship with him. If we show up before the Lord and we have no relationship with God, he has only one thing on which he can judge us, and that's our behavior. And none of our behavior is ever going to be good enough to get us into heaven. We're all flawed, and we're all going to have sin and plenty of it. But God made a way for us to show up before him in an acceptable format, and that was through relationship. God has always wanted relationship with us. He's never wanted religion. Religion is fine if it's a demonstration of a true relationship. It's kind of like giving your wife flowers and candy and all that sort of thing. If it's a really heartfelt expression of my love, then that's great. But if it's, you know, something you have to knock off every February 14th because it's expected, if you don't, you're in trouble, then it's really not much. It's not very pleasing. It doesn't really satisfy much. And that's kind of the way God is. He wants relationship. David understood that fairly early, and in his solitude, he had his guitar, and he played it, and he wrote songs. He wrote songs to God, and some of them were just out and out, gosh, you're wonderful, and some of them were, you know, look, I'm in trouble because this or that's going on, and I wish you'd, at one point he says something like, my enemy who is surrounding me, the person with whom I broke bread, has betrayed me, and I wish you would dash his baby's heads against the rocks. In other words, David's psalms are very often very natural, very honest. But he would always move from there to, but thou, O Lord, art God. After he would sort of vent his spleen, and many of his psalms start that way, he would vent his spleen, but then he'd say, but you know what, you're God, and you're in charge, and you're going to use this in my life for good. And you're going to ultimately provide justice. Even if it's on the other side, you're going to provide it, and I can trust you. And he begins to praise God. In the midst of all of that, he rises above the circumstances. You know, the Bible says that we're seated with Christ in heavenly places. It means in the Spirit. And from 30,000 feet, our problems don't look like much. Up close, they look like everything. But so David would find a way to sort of get above all of that by praising the Lord. And he would look down upon it and he would say, well, it looks like a giant, but it's, you know, God will take care of it. God will be with it. And that attitude so almost defines him. So fast forwarding, we see David brought into the public arena. He's anointed at a very early age, probably 12 or 13, to be the king. It's quite surprising. Samuel goes up to a feast in Bethlehem and on the sly tells Jesse to bring his sons forward because he's going to anoint one of them king. And Jesse brings the first seven, and Samuel said, this is none of these. You have another one. He said, yeah, we got this shepherd kid, you know. So they brought him in, and sure enough, it was him. So he was anointed to be king real early on. By the time he gets to be 16, 17, or 18, he is taking food and supplies up to his brothers whenever there's a war in Israel. Whenever there's a war, there's a small standing army, maybe 3,000 men. But when there's a war, everybody comes down. And when people go to war, the families have to provide all their support. They provide them with their weapons, they provide them with their food, all that sort of thing. There's no military budget, there's no none of that. I remember reading an article last year, 2 years ago, something about soldiers whose parents were buying them special flak jackets because they were better technology than what the Army was putting out. And they wanted their kids to have the best. And that has been, up until modern times, it's been up to the families to provide those sort of things for the most part. So he was going up taking supplies, and of course he runs across the experience of Goliath coming down, Goliath 9'2", son of the Anakim, coming down and challenging Israel. And he, just on the basis of, we're the people of God. We ought to be able to deal with this guy. And so he offers to go up against Goliath, and Saul is out of options. Nobody else is going to want to go. Saul doesn't want to go. And he has... he has a bit of experience with David, which I'll get to in just a second. And so I guess just out of desperation, he lets him go. He tries to give him his armor, but David can't carry it. It's too heavy for him. And so David said, I've gone up against bears and lions to protect the sheep. But this godless son of a Philistine shouldn't be much of a problem. And so David grabs five stones and goes up and with a slingshot. We talked about this before, but it's been, you know, somebody once said David took five stones because Goliath had four brothers. First Chronicles 19 and 20 both mention that. But so he takes him out, and all of a sudden he's got this ripple of fame. Now, Saul is a man who has a real problem with clinical depression. And his clinical depression is enhanced by the fact that he doesn't walk with God. He has a on and off relationship with God. He's more of a religious man than a person with an intimacy. And so he has no sustaining relationship with God. He's in a very high place. And because of that, the devil is constantly on him. And he deals with a morose sort of an attitude or emotional basis for his life, and he gets just out of sorts. And so somebody figures out that they should bring David in and let David play his psalms for Saul, because when David plays, the Holy Spirit comes. And so they bring in this young kid, and Saul hasn't met him yet. If they bring him in and he sits down and he plays for him, and all he's doing is just worshiping the Lord, singing these songs that God has given him. And when he does, the Holy Spirit comes into the tent, and the depression lifts off of Saul, and he's good to go for a while. And then it grabs him later again, and they call for David, he comes back. So that was his prior experience with David, was that this kid had some sort of a power or spirit about him to be able to access God. And so in that and just the sovereignty of God, he lets him go up. David begins then to develop a following, and Saul brings him in as his armor bearer, and before long he's out on raids, and before long he's having victories, and before long he's become famous. And this plays right into Saul's issues of jealousy and insecurity and whatever, and before long Saul is out trying to kill David because he's becoming more famous than Saul. The going tune of the day is Saul has killed his thousands and David has killed his ten thousands. And so David finds himself on the other end of the king's wrath on two occasions when David goes in to play for him. Instead of Saul being ministered to by his playing, Saul takes a spear and tries to pin him to the wall with it. And it's getting bad. Saul's back and forth like people are like this. Bipolar, I guess you'd call it. And at one point he's trying to figure out how to control him, so he offers his daughter, Michal, to David as a wife. And David says, well, I don't have the kind of money to give you a bride price, for a king's daughter or whatever. And Saul said, well, 100 foreskins of the Philistines would do it. Saul figures that the Philistines don't give up their foreskins easy, and that one of those guys is going to get lucky. And so David goes out in his zeal, and he brings back 200. And probably didn't count them, but he said, here they are. So he winds up marrying Michal. Saul figures he's got a spy in David's house, but the problem is that Michal falls in love with David and begins to side with David. So he's thwarted again. Saul's oldest son, Jonathan, is a mensch. Everybody loves him. He's one of the two lead commanders in Saul's small army, but anybody will follow him anywhere. He's got deeds of his own that he's done. People love him. Saul doesn't mind when Jonathan gets praised. He's the heir to the throne. And Jonathan loves David, and David loves Jonathan. And we talked about this before, but there's nothing in the Bible anywhere that says that two people can't love each other, even if they're the same gender. There's nothing that says they can't love each other passionately. It just says that human sexuality is designed by God for a purpose, that he has rules around it, and that we are meant to obey those rules. So there's nothing wrong with two people. People say, well, I can't help loving this person. Well, nobody's saying that's a problem. It's just that you're not allowed to have sex with that person. We've gotten so used in our society for sex to be a commodity that we've missed its whole purpose and everything. Not tonight's lesson. But at any rate, Jonathan loves David and David loves Jonathan. The Bible says their hearts were knit together. In fact, when Jonathan dies, David, in one of his songwriting moods, does a ode or something to Jonathan, and he says, I loved you more than the love of women. You're more precious to me than the love of women. So if he has a wife with whom he dearly loves, he loves Jonathan more, he's saying. And God does that sometimes. He sovereignly puts people together. Sometimes it's mother and daughter. Sometimes it's two sisters, whatever. Sometimes it's a boss and his employee. Sometimes he just puts them together and says, you two sort of belong to each other. And you're given to each other to look out for each other and whatever. And God does that. And it's a precious thing when he does it. We see that relationship in the relationship between Naomi and Ruth. Naomi was a woman who her husband had two sons. And it was during a time of famine, and they left in Israel and went to Moab. And when they got to Moab, the two sons married two Moabite women. One of the women was called Orpah, which if you misspell it is Oprah, which is what happens. So it's Orpah, and the other one is a girl named Ruth. Meanwhile, while they're there, the husband dies, Kilian dies, and the two sons die. And so Naomi is a widow, and the two daughter-in-laws are living with her, caring for her. And she realizes that she's basically preventing them from getting married again. And for a lot of reasons, one, that she's an alien, et cetera, et cetera. But so she encourages them to go home. She's going to go back to Israel where she can find some support there. And so she finally persuades Orpah to go home, and Orpah didn't really want to. But Ruth refuses to leave her and says a very famous passage that is very often misquoted. It's often used as a wedding song, but it says, may God do more such to me and more if anything but death separate you from me. And wherever you lodge, there I will lodge. Wherever your home, there's my home. Your people are mine. Your God is my God. We've heard this song, and it's between Ruth and Naomi. When they finally do get back there, God works a circumstance out where Ruth winds up marrying Boaz, who is a relative through the Levirate law, and Boaz becomes the and Ruth becomes the great grandparents of King David. So, at any rate, these relationships occur. And last week we were talking about the fact that David was telling Jonathan that Saul was trying to kill him, and Jonathan wasn't seeing it. So they put some test together, and sure enough, Saul got so angry with Jonathan, he threatened to kill him also, although he wouldn't have. But so they saw it. And so Jonathan, who was heir to the throne, knew that David was going to be the king after he was gone, and he was all right with that. It was just right. And Jonathan helped him to escape. Helped him to escape. So David flees into the wilderness. He goes to the wilderness of Judah. And I brought this tonight just to help us out a little bit. I'll just pass this around. This is a little bit of a map of Israel at that time. And that's, I want to give you a little perspective. He goes into the, we have to share a couple of them, but he goes into the wilderness of Judah, which is the southern part of Israel, and he begins to hide there in some fortresses, caves that are there, natural caves and whatever, to hide from Saul. We read some of those stories last week. And when he is fleeing from Saul, one of the things he does is he's fleeing in a hurry. He's leaving without weapons or anything else, and food or whatever. So he stops off at Nob. Now, if you look, I'm not sure that's on here. Let me see. If you look at Jerusalem, that's not the reason I've got it here, but no, it's not. If you look at Jerusalem, immediately north of Jerusalem is a city called Nob. It's on Mount Scopus, which is one of the little mounts there. And then above that is Anathoth. So Anathoth's where Jeremiah comes from. But Nob is where the priests are at this particular point in time. Because remember, there's no temple yet. There's a tabernacle, but there's no temple. And the priests live in Nob. And so he stops off at Nob. And because one thing, he needs food. And remember, we talked about this last week. The priest there, Ahimelech, gives him bread, show bread. We talked about the whole implications of religion versus relationship, and how the show bread was supposed to be eaten by the priest, but in this point of necessity, it was given to David for him to eat. Remember, we talked about all that and how Jesus referred to this when he said they were talking about his disciples picking grains on the Sabbath and eating, and said they were working. And she said, "Don't you remember that David ate the show bread that was only allowed for the priest?" And you know, when you know, God, it's about the spirit of the law, not about the letter of the law. Well, he gets this bread, and he asked him if there's any weapons there, and he said, "Well, the sword of Goliath, the Hittite is here, the Gathite is here," and so he said, "Well, give me that." So that becomes David's weapon of choice for his weapon for the rest of his days. So then he flees, and he flees into the wilderness. We talked a little bit about some more of that last week, but we'll short that out. And I'm in Psalm, I'm 1 Samuel 22, verse 6, on top of page 80. Now Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. One of the things I mentioned last week is that when David finally settles out in the wilderness, first of all of his family have to go out there because they're now enemies. Any of his friends go out there. David has to take his parents to Moab to keep them safe by getting the king of Moab to watch over them. Remember, his grandmother was a Moabite. He's got family there. Then anybody he said who was in distress or downtrodden or depressed or in any way whatsoever broken goes out to David. And so David has now a new group of people made of the problem children, the misfits, the lame, the maimed, the poor. Yeah, that's how it always starts, you know. It starts in a startup mode. So all these people have come to David, and that's David's following. He has 400, 500, 600 men at some point in here, and their wives and their children. And so now he's got to provide for all those people. So Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was sitting in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree on the height with a spear in his hand, and his servants were standing around him. And Saul said to his servants who stood around him, "Hear now, O Benjamites, will the son of Jesse also give to all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands, commanders of hundreds? For all of you have conspired against me, so that there is no one who discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you who is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in ambush as it is this day." So David had gone to Gibeah, and they had supported him, and then he moved on. And Saul is now confronting these Gibeonites with the fact that they had done this. So then Doug the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, said to him, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him, and gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine." Doug was one of many people who were descendants of Esau. The Edomites are descendants of Esau. And a number of these people over the years have joined themselves to Israel for a variety of reasons. Some of them fled home, and they're hanging out here because they can. They're in the army or whatever. But he's not Jewish, and he has no sensitivities around that issue. And so he says, "Well, I saw Jesse going to Nob, and Ahimelech, that would be the high priest, he gave him food and provisions and weapons." People have been watching what's going on. They see, for instance, that Jonathan has sided with David. Then the king sent someone to summon Ahimelech, the priest, son of Ahitub, and all his father's household, and the priests were in Nob, and all of them came to the king. Saul said, "Listen now, son of Ahitub," and he answered and said, "Here I am, my lord." And Saul said to him, "Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day?" Saul's depression and his bipolarism is creating a paranoia in him, which we see growing as time goes on, and finally killing him. We'll get to that eventually. Ahimelech answered the king, and he said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house? Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today?" He said, "Well, wait a minute. Why are you fussing at me about taking care of David? He is the captain of your bodyguard. He's constantly leading forays for you. He's honored in your court. And this isn't the first time that I have asked God directions and guidance for him when he's gone off on a journey. How is it you expect me to not do this for him? Far be it from me. Do not let the king impute anything to his servants or to any of the household of my father, for your servant knows nothing at all of this affair." He said, I had no idea there's problems between you, or that he was persona non grata. The king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's household." And the king said to the guards who were attending them, "Turn around and put the priest of the Lord to death, because her hand is also with David, and because they knew he was fleeing and did not reveal it." The paranoia grows, and then it becomes a mania. And after a while, we see Saul becoming an irrational being who's just constantly reaching out, slaughtering people who he thinks are siding with David. Servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hand to attack the priests of the Lord. These are Jews, and they're not going to kill the Pope. I mean, you know, it's so you kill the Pope, you know, because there's God. He's bigger than you. So the king said to Doug, "You turn around and attack the priest." And Doug the Edomite turned around and attacked the priest, and he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. The ephod is a sort of a waistcoat or a kind of an apron, high apron from here down to the waist. And the high priest ephod has a pocket in it. And in the pocket are kept two stones, Urim and Thummim, which are used for casting lots. One of them means yes, the other means no. And so that's part of the high priest's garb. So 85 men who wore the linen ephod were killed that day. And he struck Nob, the city of the priests, to the edge of the sword, both men and women and children, infants, donkeys, oxen, sheep. He struck to the edge of the sword. So he wastes the city of Nob over this issue. One son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David, and Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priest of the Lord. David said to Abiathar, "I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul. I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household. Stay with me and do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, for you're safe with me." He said, I knew I should have offed his head that day. I knew what he would do. Then they told David, said, "Behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and are plundering the threshing floors." Now, God has a role for David. He has a purpose for David, and the process of it is taking a long time. It starts at age 12, and David's going to get to be king at about age 30. And then he's going to get to be king of Judah only for 7 years, and before he's king of all of Israel. So this process takes time, and God does that in our lives. He does things over long arcs of time. And part of it, our challenge is to trust him over those long arcs, that he's going to bring us to places that he has for us. So here we are with David. He's a fugitive in the wilderness, and theoretically kind of at the nadir, or the bottom of the trough of being honored or respected or whatever. He's an outlaw. But God is going to raise him from here. And one of the things he does is he causes David to become a champion of the people. Now, the thing I sent you around, if you look down at the bottom, there's a circle. The bottom tribe of all of the 12 tribes is Judah, and it backs up against the Brook of Egypt, which is the separates the land of Egypt from... It's on top of that. And, of course, Sinai is all down there and all that sort of thing. Now, below, there's a bunch of cities in there. You can see Bethlehem and all that sort of thing, Hebron. And Hebron is about the southernmost usable city. In fact, there are times when the capital of Israel before we ever get Jerusalem is Hebron, because it's defensible. Below that you see Ziph, and off to the right of that you see En-Gedi, and then the farthest city in Israel all is Beersheba, which is out in the Qumran area. I mean, it's way down there. So David is down living in the wilderness. And the thing about the wilderness, a wilderness is not a desert. A wilderness is a place that is brown and less water's there, and then it blooms. And it'll be brown for so many months, and then a rain will fall, and it'll just grow up like crazy. A desert is not that way. A wilderness. But one of the things about the wilderness of Judah was it was full of rock formations, caves, etc., etc. And the Judeans used it from the time they got there until the very end to hide from larger and bigger armies. They couldn't get them out of these rabbit warrens. And so David is down there in the natural fortresses that provide themselves. There are people who live in these wildernesses. These are people who live, they live out, you know. They're like pioneers we've had before, and they live out. Or like if you have a landlocked Australia or whatever, they don't live around the cities of the coast, they live out. And as such, they are susceptible to attack from marauders and from other countries that are trying to, on their way marching into whatever. And so they live rough out there. They have to be armed and all that sort of thing. And David becomes a protector for these people. Because he's there with an army of men, people begin to come to him and for help. And little by little, he secures all of this area over a period of years, until eventually his sphere of providing security goes all the way north into all of Judah. So his kingdom is going to begin here at the bottom of all of this, when he's at his worst. And it's going to begin with a bunch of people who are depressed and downtrodden and in debt and deserters and all kinds of people who are in trouble. That's what God makes his kingdom out of. So the people from Keilah inquired of David, saying, "Can you help us out?" So David asked the Lord. He says to the Lord, "Shall I go and attack these Philistines?" And the Lord said to him, "Go and attack and deliver Keilah." But David's men said to him, "We are afraid here in Judah. How much more than if we go to Keilah against the ranks of the Philistines? We're small, we're not much, we are hiding, and you want us to go up against the Philistines." It's a new relationship. There, you know, he's got to, you know, he's got to persuade people to do what he wants, and he's extraordinarily dependent upon God, and he knows it. He goes to God for everything. Should I do this? Should I do that? He's operating out of his relationship because it's all he's got. David's solitude has actually served him well by causing him to have to develop his relationship with God. One of the problems that we have in our world today is the sheer busyness of it, because it keeps us, and there's so much, especially in our world, there's so much we can depend upon that therefore we don't need to go to God. And God has this little thing he does every once in a while when he's trying to get our attention, is he strips away everything that we depend on and causes us to have to come to him so that we'll rediscover that relationship. But David has been this way since the beginning, and it's serving him well. So we're going to see a number of times when everybody who's with David is angry with David about something he's done, but David goes to God. And he sticks with God. And God likes that. Abraham believed God, and it was counted him as righteousness, and he was known as a friend of God. And that's what David is. He's a friend of God in the midst of all of this sort of thing. I want to be a friend of God. More than anything else in the whole world, I want to be a friend of God. Because there's nothing better than that. And it isn't always easy, but there's nothing better than that. So David goes back to the Lord. He says, the men are afraid. They're afraid to go up. Should we go up? He inquired of the Lord once more, and the Lord answered and said, arise and go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines in your hand. So David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines. Then he led away their livestock and struck them with a great slaughter. Thus David delivered the inhabitants of Keilah. So David gets to the point where he's going, look, I'm going up against the Philistines, y'all come or not. And so they follow him. What else are they going to do? You know, they can't go back to Saul. They've thrown their lot in. And so, but these early initial battles build a confidence in them that's not there immediately. You know, these early initial battles cause them in time to just follow David wherever he goes. But it has to be developed. And we don't start off with fully formed weapons in our hand. We always start off in need, and the call to seek the Lord. There's a scripture in Isaiah. It says, if we weary when we run against the foot soldiers, then what are we going to do when we have to run with the cavalry? And so the point is there's a sense that we need to deal with little things in order to strengthen us for bigger things. So we need to learn to trust the God in the midst of smaller difficulties. So if cancer strikes, we can trust him in the midst of that. Or bankruptcy, or the loss of a loved one, or whatever. Our relationship with God it's not something you can go into Dillard's and buy one, and I want the most expensive one, please. It doesn't come that way. This happens small, and it builds, and it grows, and it's one faithfulness put upon another faithfulness, upon another faithfulness, and it convinces us in our heart that we can trust him, because we trusted him for that step, and that step, and that step, and eventually we get to where we believe we can walk before God. And whatever they sin against us, those people who walked into the arena with their children in their hand, to face the lions, that wasn't the first day they ever trusted God. That wasn't the first day they ever trusted God. To have the faith to be able, and during the persecutions, when the Romans, and you've been in jail, and now it's your day to go into the lions and fight with the tigers, and you go in the arena and fight with the lions and the gladiators. And these people walked in with mother, husband, wife, with their children. And they walk in there, and they face all of this with courage, and they get destroyed. And we're told both biblically and historically that whenever people have seen martyrdom, it strikes people that that's an incredible thing. The church is built on the blood of the martyrs. I'll give you another story, true story. John Wesley was an Anglican minister for 12 years. 10 to 12 at this point. He had grown up one of 18 children in his father's parsonage. His father was a dissenting pastor, which means he wasn't a full Anglican high church, person based on religion. He was based on relationship with God. His mother was, what was her name?
Susanna,
yeah. Was an amazing woman. She had 18 children. John was 17th. She taught them Greek and Latin, English, math and arts, stuff like that. So what are we doing? Okay, so I grew up Catholic, so we've been around a lot of these kind of families. Nancy had one friend that she knew had, I don't know, bunches of kids, 10, 12, whatever. And they had a big lazy Susan in the middle of the table, and they put the food on it and just spun it like that. But one of the things that happens is the older children diaper the younger children, and everybody's got a job, and everybody jumps in and does stuff. And anyway, it works when it works, and that's how it works. John Wesley was in a house fire. The parsonage had burned down. And he was miraculously saved out of the fire, and his mother told him that God had plucked him from the fire as a brand from the burning because he had a purpose for him. Wesley and John Wesley and his older brother Charles went to Oxford. They were smart. Went to Oxford. And while they were there at Oxford, they were given 24 pounds a year to live on. I don't know what that is, but it's a living wage. And they chose to live on four and take the other 20 pounds and use it. They went into the local prisons. People were in debtor's prison. They went into the local prison and they created shoe factories. They would bring in materials, stuff like that. These people would make shoes and then they would sell them so that people could pay their debt and get out of prison. They brought in food. They brought in medical supplies. John Wesley actually wrote a couple of small books on medicine, common, ordinary, everyday medicine. And he was ordained as an Anglican minister after he finished his two university stints. Nancy and I were there. He was at Christ Church, where his picture is, and then he was at New College to get his doctoral work and whatever. And then he was ordained, and he is 12 years now he's been a minister. Charles Wesley gets called by Governor Oglethorpe, who is the governor over the British colony of Georgia, which is a penal colony. He gets asked by Governor Oglethorpe to come and be an administrator. And so Charles has gone to Savannah to work for Governor Oglethorpe, and John's over in England, and he's sort of not sure what he wants to do. And Charles gets him a commission through the governor to become the pastor of Savannah. And so he gets on a ship, and he's coming across the ocean to Savannah, and it is a particularly rough trip. And it gets so bad that even the sailors are afraid. But there is a group of people on board called the Moravians. The Moravians were a small group of Christians that were put together in a communal style by Count Zinzendorf up in Moravia. That's why they're called Moravians. And they had these were very deeply committed, evangelical, relation-based Christians. And there were a bunch of them that were colonizing America. They had come over on the same ship. And there was probably a dozen or so couples and their children. And the Moravians and their children were unafraid to die. They were noticeably unafraid to die. They were going around comforting the sailors and other passengers. They were holding little prayer meetings. These storms would rage for days. And people had given up hope, and they were encouraging people. And so they managed to get there, and John Wesley starts his ministry there. He thought he was going to evangelize the American Indians, all of them. He was planning on converting all of them. And he didn't do too well with that, and he didn't do too well with a lot of things. He fell in love with a girl named Sophie Hopke, and she had the good enough sense to marry somebody else who had a real career. And he got angry about it, and he preached a sermon from the pulpit that was a very thinly veiled slam on her for her unfaithfulness in not marrying him. And it was so thinly veiled that her husband and brothers, etc., went up and pulled the feathers out and of the mattresses and heated up the tar because they were going to run him out on a rail. He heard about it, so he books it to the port and catches the first ship back to England. Man of courage. And so he's first ship back to England. And on the way back, the storms are incredibly bad again. And once again, there are Moravians going back to England to bring more people back. And these same people are at peace and at rest. They're not afraid to die. They, you know, they're, well, we may die, but if we die, we die. You know, we're going to be with the Lord. It's fine. And it so impresses John Wesley that he says, what have you got that I don't have? I've been ordained for 12 years as a minister. I've been walking with the Lord, as far as I know, since I was a kid. What do you got that I don't have? So they tried to explain it to him, but except his university education, whatever. And so they said to him, there is a meeting in Aldersgate Street that meets every Wednesday night, certain time. And when you get back to London, why don't you look it up and see if some of the Moravians there can help you. So he goes into this meeting. It's like May 17, 1738. He goes into this meeting on Aldersgate Street, and he hears a guy preaching on Martin Luther's treatment of the Book of Romans, with the emphasis on we are saved by grace through faith and not by works, lest any man should boast. Because Wesley is an Anglican, he's grown up around the whole idea of good works save you, being good saves you, doing the right thing saves you, whatever. And he suddenly gets this idea that we're saved by faith through grace and not by works, lest any man should boast. He suddenly gets that it's the relationship with God that saves us, not our good works. And he wrote down that his heart became strangely warmed and he was no longer afraid to die. So this Anglican minister, 12 years, grown up in this Christian home, the whole nine yards, has his encounter with God at 35 years of age. And that's when he becomes born again. After all that religious walk and everything, that's when he becomes born again. Because he suddenly gets it that it's the relationship with the Lord, the faith. Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness or right relationship. The word righteousness means right relationship. Doesn't mean sinlessness. And it was counted him as righteous, and therefore he became a friend of God. And if you look down through the Bible, you see Adam, and you see Seth, and you see Enoch, and you see Noah, and you see Abraham, and Jacob, and Isaac, and all these kind of people, and Sarah, all these biblical stars, Moses, whatever. And what you see in common about them is they all had a relationship with God. They were typically religious also, but it was their relationship that saved them. The religion was their expression, not a substitute. And what we do all too often, what mankind does, and what Israel often did, was we substitute the religion for the relationship. We get into the ritual. We go to church all the time. We do all this kind of stuff. But we abandon the day-by-day conversational, intimate relationship with God. And so the power goes out of our life. David, he knew this. And one of the things that happened to him that was very helpful was God kept putting him in bad situations. That lion he was fighting, that bear he was fighting for the sheep, and all that sort of thing. The thing with Goliath, the fact that his king is trying to kill him, the fact that he's having to flee, all this kind of stuff. He has all these difficulties. And rather than relate to them like standpoint of this isn't fair and all this kind of stuff and, whatever, he relates to them from the standpoint that God is good all the time, which means he's good now during the difficult times. And I can try. He's doing something in my life. And Paul says, Romans 8:28, that all things work together for good or for our goodness, for our benefit. For those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose, he says, all things work together for our benefit if we love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. He didn't say for everybody. If we love the Lord, we're called according to his purpose. If we are intimately associated with him, he will use everything in our life, good or bad, for our good. He will use it for our benefit. You know, the angels, when they came to Bethlehem, did not say, peace on earth and goodwill to men. They did not say that. Hallmark said that. The angel said, peace on earth to men of goodwill. Jesus came to bring peace on earth to men of goodwill, not to everybody. Jesus said, I didn't come to bring peace. I came to bring a sword. I'm going to separate one from another based on who's walking with God and who's not. Jesus said, while you're in the world, you will have tribulation. Be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. So if we love the Lord, we're called according to his purpose. Hebrews 11:6 says, if you want to please God, you must believe that he is and that he's a rewarder of those who seek him. If you want to please God, these things get simple after a while. Believe that he is, he exists, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. Now, Jesus told a story. He said, which of you who has a son who asks him for a fish would give him a snake? Or ask for a piece of bread would give him a rock? Or another time, ask him for an egg, would give him a scorpion. He said, if you who are corrupted by sin would not do that, if you would give good gifts to your children, then how much more would the Heavenly Father give good gifts to His children? Now, we often, as you know, put our children through very difficult times. You won't know that yet, but you will shortly, you know, eventually. We put our children through things like school, you know. They'll tell you, oh, don't make me go to school. I'll die. I'll hate you. I'll never speak to you again. Don't make me get those stitches. Put a Band-Aid on it. You know, Ben had a gap in his forehead. You know, it took 38 stitches, 28 subfacial and 10 surface stitches to close it up. And he said, just put a Band-Aid on it. It'll be fine. He could have stole quarters and roll of quarters in there. And I knew, in my wisdom, that if I didn't get that fixed, he could never get chicks. And I knew he'd be glad later that I did. But at the time, he swore it would kill him. He swore he would hate me, he would never speak to me again. He was absolutely, positively sure that what I was doing was evil. So four or five of us held him down while he screamed and yelled, and the people going into Kroger's were wondering what was going on. We were in a dock in a box. Nancy and Todd were walking out front praying, trying to sing loud enough to keep the kids yelling down. But anyway, that afternoon he told his friends, it took 38 in the face, man, no sweat. And the throughout the next year or so, he had stitches again, and he never reacted badly to them again. He knew that, you know, you get the zytocaine in, everything's going to be okay, and he toughened it out. But he was sure. And we are. We're sure that what our parents are doing is evil. But the truth of the matter is perspective and history will show us that many of the things they did are enabled us to function and behave, whatever. And parents aren't perfect or anything, but, you know, they're also not all evil. So if God knows, if we don't have a good gift to our children, even though they sometimes, you know, it may be a wriggle and hiss, but it's a fish. It may almost break your teeth, but it's bread. You know, there's a trust factor. All salvation's based in relationship. All relation's based in trust. And David trusted God. David had no one but God. Had no one but God. I can't tell you how many times in my life I have prayed, I have no one on here on earth but you, God. Now, I had a loving wife and I had, you know, some good friends around me, but when push came to shove, I had God. He's what I had. My loving wife could die and leave me, then what would I do? But I grew up, kind of by God's grace, as a loner. And I grew up, I was better with adults than with kids. Part of it was the way I was raised and whatever. And so I grew up that way. And I used to hate it. I thought, you know, this is a horrible life I live. And as time went on, I began to see there was a strength in it, that God used it in my life. And it was 1987 or 8 before I ever had a supportive friend in my life who could actually help me along, ever. So God uses these things, and we see it in David. We look at David in the overall thing, we say, there's a great guy. I mean, there's this giant of a man, and he was king, and he was a warrior, and he defeated everybody, and he was popular, you know, all this kind of stuff, and he had money and power and all this kind of stuff. Well, all that was true eventually to some degree. But the truth of the matter is when we look at David, when we do the forensics on him, he started off as a lonely kid who glommed onto one thing, and that was, all I have is you, God. You know, this is a kid who missed all of the, you know, he got brought in for Christmas and Easter, you know, or Sabbath or something, but you know, all the other stuff, he was with the sheep. You're laughing.
No, I just never thought of it.
Yeah. You know, it's why the youngest always gets this job. It's something they can do, and you know, it gets passed down. Anyway, so here he is, he's in the wilderness, and God has now brought him to these people. He's going to go out and save these people. So he goes down there and he defeats the Philistines, a small group of men against a much larger group of men. And this is one of, gosh, dozens and dozens of stories in the Bible. Gideon takes 300 men against an army. Abraham takes 318 men against the five kings. I mean, and God uses confusion and all kinds of other things to make those 300 or 500 or trusting souls effective. He uses circumstances and makes it work because they trust in the Lord in that scenario. So he gets victory. And when he gets victory, he returns people's stuff to them. But now he's got goods and supplies. You know, we talk about this many times before too, but one of the time-honored ways for people without birth to make their fortunes in the world up until, gosh, recent times was through warfare. Captains, people. If your firstborn son got the manor, the secondborn son got the vicarage. The thirdborn son was sent to the army at age 12, or the navy at age 12, where he became a midshipman and began to learn how to manage men. And he would have men in his 20s and 30s that he would oversee. If y'all saw Master and Commander, the movie with Russell Crowe. You know, remember that kid who got his arm cut off? The sailors who were 25, 30 years old or whatever, they would speak to these young kids and call them Lord Johnson because they were the son of some lord. And what happened is, or if you saw the movie Persuasion from Jane Austen, one of the things, they had this ridiculous guy there, he was snobbish, whatever, and he said he really hated the Navy because it gave men of obscure birth the opportunity to gain wealth. I mean, it was one of those things. But people would go out on the battlefield and make money. They would capture ships, send them back, and they would sell everything, and they would divvy it up with the officers and the captains getting the bulk of it. This is how people earn money who didn't have birth, who didn't have land and privilege or whatever. And so it is here. Whenever these guys go to battle, remember, they're providing their own supplies. They're also getting the spoil divided. And so little by little, God is going to enrich David by this process of sending him out to rescue people. And all of a sudden, they're getting things they need. Weapons, supplies, things to eat, whatever. Now it came about, let's see, I think, I'm on 23, I think, huh? 23:6. It came about when Abiathar the son of Ahimelech fled to David at Keilah. He came down with an ephod in his hand. So he brought his ephod with him. When it was told that Saul that David had come to Keilah, Saul said, "God has delivered into my hand, for he shut himself up in by entering a city with double gates and bars." So David had gone, he'd captured the city of Keilah. The city of Keilah would have been a nicer place to live than the cave of Adullam. And so David was, there, and people were starting to get settled in. Remember, they killed every man, woman, and child, cat, dog, and whatever there they didn't want. So Saul summoned all the people for war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. David knew that Saul was plotting against him, so he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod here." And David said, "O Lord God of Israel, thy servant has heard for certain that Saul is seeking to come to Keilah, destroy the city on my account. Will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand?" I'm sorry. Keilah wasn't the people he killed. Keilah was the people who rescued. That's right. So he's living with them. Will they surrender him into my hand? When Saul came down, just as will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand? Will Saul come down just as thy servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell thy servant. And the Lord said, "He will come down." And David said, "Will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul?" And the Lord said, "They will surrender you." David and his men, about 600, rose, departed from Keilah, wherever they could go. And when it was told Saul that David escaped from Keilah, he gave up pursuit. David stayed in the wilderness and the strongholds and remained in the hill country, in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. If you go back to your little map, where I put that circle on the map, toward the top you see the town of Ziph. But you see the town of Ziph, and to the right of it you see En Gedi. We're going to read also that David hangs out in the wilderness of En Gedi. Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. So David is able to escape Saul. His raiding parties can't find him because David's moving from place to place throughout the wilderness. This is not a fun existence, but it's necessary. The areas west of the Gedi wilderness of Judah, there are many caves and springs available to those who know where to look. Once David left Keilah, see, I think I've called all that. Now, this is a time in David's life of daily dependence on the Lord for survival.
So when they were throwing those Urim and Thummim to get the answers, like
Urim and Thummim are two gemstones, and one of them means yes, and the other one means no. And so they're in a pocket on this blouse, and so it's like, you know, when you're taking things out of a bowl, they reach in without looking, pull one out, and it either says yes or no. Urim and Thummim was a practice that went way back to Sinai, that God used as a mechanism, simple mechanism, to give them directions. You know, yes or no. And so they often use it. It's called casting lots. And casting lots means just that, you know. Okay?
Yeah, so that's when he asked the question. Then
yeah,
he drew
it's a yes or no. You know, it's kind of like that black ball with the 8 on it, you know. Yeah. Should I go up? Go, you know, whatever. That's what it was. So they're trusting that God's going to speak to them in this way. And they're, because it's coming out of the ephod, it's coming out of the high priest's pocket robe, you know. And God told him to do that at times. There are times when God told him to do it that way. So it's an age-old practice. David became aware that Saul had come out to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God. So at this point in time, Jonathan comes to see him. And I mentioned last week that was the last time he saw him, but that was wrong. This is the last time he saw him. I forgot about this trip. So Jonathan goes to meet David to encourage him. Encourage him in God. Anybody who's around Saul, who's got any honesty whatsoever, knows that Saul is off his rocker. He knows that Saul is wrong about David, that David has not been dishonorable, that David's been nothing but faithful, that his hatred of David is neurotic, it's not justified. And Jonathan is one of the people who tell him so. We had that episode where Saul tried to kill Jonathan because of this. He was out of his mind, as he often was. And he said, "Don't you know that he's going to take your throne?" And Jonathan's attitude is, "You know, I'd be glad for David to have the throne. If that's what God wants, I'd be glad to serve him." So he said, "Do not be afraid, David, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you. And you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul, my father, knows that also." So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. Then the Ziphites came up to Saul at Gibeah and said, "Is David not hiding with us in the strongholds at Horesh, in the hill of Hakalah, which is south of Jeshimon?" Yeah, there's always money to be made. "Now then, O king, come down according to all desire of your soul, and do so, and our part which we shall surrender you into God's hand, king's hand." And Saul said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, for you have had compassion on me. Go now and make more sure, investigate, and see that this place is where his haunt is, and who has seen him here, for I am told he's very cunning. So look and learn all about the hiding place where he hides himself. Return to me with certainty, and I will go with you. It shall come about, if he is in the land, that I will search him out among all the thousands of Judah." So go spy on him, plot out his hiding spots and all that kind of stuff, whatever. So then they arose and they went to Ziph before Saul. Now David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon in the Arabah to the south of Jeshimon. When Saul and his men went to seek him, they told David. And he came to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon. When Saul heard it, he pursued David in the wilderness of Maon. Saul went on to one side of the mountain, David and his men on the other side of the mountain, and David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were surrounding David and his men to seize him. Close call, many of them. A messenger came to Saul saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land. So Saul has to break off his chase of David just when he's got him pincered, because the Philistines have attacked the land and Saul's got to go back. Saul returned from pursuing David, went to meet the Philistines. Therefore, they called that place the Rock of Escape. David went up from there and stayed in the strongholds of En Gedi.
Sounds like these are places where Bin Laden
hid and all that. Yeah, that's kind of stuff. The Jews, there's many references in the Bible to the Jews hiding out in all of their caves and stuff. So one thing is most of the militaries were massive armies, and the better ones had chariots, which are good on the plains but not in the hills. And the Judean hills saved the Jews dozens of times. There's a reference in one of the prophets about people fleeing from judgment, the judgment of God. And one of the things it says is that the caves will, that the floors of the caves are covered in bat dung and golden idols are laying all over the place. Because what happens is people are fleeing and they're bringing all their treasure with them, but when they get to a certain place, they can't eat it, they can't carry it, so they just drop it there in the bat dung and keep on moving in order to get away. It's kind of like sometimes our pioneers would start off with a Conestoga wagon, they have a piano in it and this and that and all this stuff, you know, and they'd wind up walking into Oregon with a sack full of, you know, tree seeds and everything else, including half their relatives, are all strewed along the coast because they were taking with them stuff they really couldn't carry. So yeah, it was like that. And you know, this is not a fun life. I mean, it's got its moments, you know. I mean, sitting around the campfire enjoying one another, whatever. But you know, at any minute you could be aroused. Somebody comes to camp and says, Saul's got a troop and they're 3 miles away, and you know, the Ziphites have told him where you are or whatever. David lives in this condition for years. And like I said, we have a tendency to see him in his palace. In fact, when he finally does get to live in his palace is when he gets in trouble. Because his wealth and his power cause him to forget God for a while. 1 Samuel 24:1. This is a really neat story. It's a very human story. It came about when Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines. He was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En Gedi." So Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all of Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the rocks of the wild goats. Came to the sheepfolds on the way, and there was a cave. And Saul went in to relieve himself. Okay, it's in the Bible there, folks. It happens. And David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave. And the men of David said to him, "Behold, this is the day which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I'm going to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as seems good to you.'" He's in the back of a cave. Saul is squatting down with his weapons laying on the side, relieving himself. And David could put a spear through him in a heartbeat. And his men said, "This is it. God has given you into his hand." Then David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly. Now, this is, imagine, he's slipping up behind him and he's snipping a piece of this robe off with his sword in such a way as not to alert Saul that he's there. And then he's backing all up. Got to be a wonderful time. It came about afterwards that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. Now we're going to get to this. So he said to his men, "Far be it from me because of the Lord that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him since he is the Lord's anointed." Now, one of the things that David knew, and David's theology is really deep, is very advanced. But he knew that Saul was the king of Israel. And he knew that it was God's job to deal with Saul, not his. And so, if at all possible, he was not going to harm Saul. He was just going to stay out of his way and let God deal with it. David knew what it meant to honor authority, even when authority wasn't always right or always good.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
It said that God was giving Saul over to him. to do whatever seems good to you. And so isn't that like a license to kill?
Pardon?
Isn't that like a license to kill?
No. Well, I put it to you this way. We might think that God has given our president over to do all manner of evil things. Is that a license for us to kill him? Mm-hmm. And David's right that he's not supposed to kill Saul.
Okay.
We'll see this more as we go along.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things that set David apart from this is that he knows how to submit to authority, even and honor authority, even when authority is not honorable itself.
Okay, so being delivered to you doesn't mean that you're automatically entitled to harm.
According to these men, this is David's golden opportunity to take his head off. And he was saying, they said, God's given him to you right now to do with whatever you want. God set this up.
Yeah.
And David goes and slices a little piece off of his robe, and the purpose, he wants for a purpose.
Yeah.
He wants to point out to Saul that he could have killed him.
Right.
But even afterwards, he feels bad about having done that.
Okay.
So let's just read on, and we'll get to this. So David arose and cut off the edge of his robe. He came out afterward. David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. So he said to his men, "Far be it from me, because of the Lord, that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed." Now the first L, Lord, is a little L. That's my Lord, the King. And the Lord's anointed, that is a big L. That's God, the Lord's anointed. To stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed. David persuaded his men with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. And Saul arose and left the cave and went on his way. Now continuing on down here. Afterwards, David arose and went out of the cave and he called after Saul from a distance, okay, saying, "My lord the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, "Saul, why do you listen to the words of men, saying, 'Behold, David seeks to harm you'? Behold, this day as your eyes have seen that the Lord has given you into my hand in the cave. And some said to kill you, but my eye had pity on you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Now my father," he says to him, see, it's an honorific, "indeed, see the edge of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the edge of your robe and did not kill you, no one perceived that there's no evil or rebellion in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you are lying in wait for my life to take it. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge me on you by my hand, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A single flea? The Lord therefore be judge and decide between you and me, and may he see and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand." So he confronts Saul with his behavior, his erroneous beliefs, his attitudes, the fact he's listened to the people, his jealousies. And he says, I could have killed you, but I didn't, because it's not my job to do that. It's God's job to deal with you. And by this action, you should see that I am loyal, I'm not rebellious, that you have no reason to be chasing after me. Now I want to go to a little story here before I finish this one. This is a very famous story that has to do with Miriam and Aaron and Moses. When Moses went back to Egypt to deliver the people, he encountered his older brother and his older sister. Miriam was, when Moses was put in the basket, it was Miriam who pushed the basket down the stream and followed along and found out that he had been taken by the daughter of the Pharaoh and went up to her and offered a nursemaid and whatever. So Miriam is older. She's 12 or so years older than Moses, something like that. And Aaron's older. So when Moses starts leading the people and all this stuff's happening, he brings them in the desert, whatever, they get to Mount Sinai and all the stuff that goes on. And remember, they have the thing where Aaron starts making the golden calf and Moses comes down and all this sort of thing. Eventually what happens is this all sort of settles out. And Moses has got himself in a situation now where he's managing these people. And he's so busy doing this that his wife and two sons left him. They went back to Midian. When Moses had fled Egypt, he had fled to Midian. Moses was not raised as a Jew. He had no idea who the God of Abraham was. But when he goes to Midian, he encounters Jethro, Jethro is a priest of Midian, and Midian was one of the sons of Abraham through his wife Keturah. Abraham married Keturah after Sarah died, and he had six sons, and one of them was Midian. And we get the story of the Bible down through Israel, and it gets you the impression that maybe they're the only people following God. But for a long time, it's not true. There are many other people coming out of Noah and out of Abraham who are following God, but they're not part of the story, so they're only mentioned peripherally. One of those is Job. Job is a contemporary with Abraham. He was known as the most righteous man in the East. Abraham's the most righteous man in the West. Job is not a Jew at all. He's not a Semite. He's probably not a Semite. He's probably a Japhethite. But at any rate, he's certainly not part of the stream there. But he's walking with the Lord because the knowledge of God has come forward and has not yet died off in those particular areas. When Moses had gotten to Midian, he's escaped from Pharaoh. He lives for 40 years in the house of Midian, the priest of Jethro, the priest of Midian, marries his oldest daughter Zipporah, and he keeps sheep for 40 years. And he keeps sheep at the foot of Sinai, which is also called Horeb. And one of the things that Midian explains to him who the God of Abraham was, because he wouldn't have known otherwise. And he tells him all about the God of Abraham. And so his knowledge and understanding of the God of Abraham comes from Jethro, priest of Midian. And he tells him that this mountain is God's mountain, and that that God is often seen on the mountain. Well, the mountain's volcanic. And so Moses is out in that time frame. He's keeping sheep. And he looks up on the side of the mountain, and he sees that there's a big bush up there on fire, which is not an uncommon thing. The stuff comes out of the volcano from time to time, and it catches stuff on fire, and it burns out. But this thing won't burn out. It just keeps on burning. So he goes up on the mountain to see what this is, and God speaks to him out of the burning bush, and he has this whole thing. God introduces himself to himself, and he says, "Well, who are you?" And he said, "I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And he said, "I want you to go to your people." He said, "I don't know who those people are. I don't know anything about this, you know." Anyway, all that happens. So now, they brought the people here, and they brought them to the Sinai, and God is, and Abraham and Moses is now managing all these people. It's 2,000 men, women and children, 2 million men, women and children. He's now in a place where it's administrative. He, remember, he's gone up on the mountain. He's brought back the Ten Commandments. He's come back with 613 regulations of what the hell they need to do. He's got instructions on how to build the tabernacle. They're doing all this kind of stuff. You know, they're spending all this time at the foot of the mountain. And he is trying to solve all the issues that are. He's trying to manage everything. Well, after a period of time, they get on this journey, and Jethro shows up with Moses' wife and two kids. He's had enough grandparenting for a while. So he shows up and he said, "I brought you back your wife and your kids." And, you know, Moses is going, "Well, I was kind of doing pretty well without him, actually." But Jethro stays for a while and he watches what Moses is doing. And he said, "This is nuts." He said, "You can't possibly do what you're trying to do. It's unsustainable. You won't be able to do it well." So he said, "Here's what you should do. You should put men over 50s, men over hundreds, men over thousands, etc., and make and cause them to handle the issues at their level. And just let the stuff that's really critical, that pumps to the top, just you deal with those. And have all these other people to do this." And that's what he does. God blesses that, and it's a process, and it works. From that point on, that's how they're organized. Men over 10s, men over 100s, men over 50s, men over 100s, men over 1,000s. And that's how it works. And so eventually all those people below him, they learn how to manage stuff. And he only has to deal with the odd and end stuff that pops to the top, which at first is a lot, but it gets to be less. And so now he's got time for home life. All right. So as they're going along, after a while, Miriam gets a little crosswise with this process. And she's going, "You know, I used to diaper his butt. And he's walking around here like he's the lord of the manor. And, you know, Aaron and I, we do a lot of leadership around here too. And he's getting all the accolades for this kind of thing. And, you know, and he went and married this non-Jewish woman. I mean, he's married to this Cushite. And, you know, so he isn't perfect." And so this situation pops up. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? They said, is it only through Moses that God has spoken? Has he not spoken through us as well? And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. And he would not defend himself. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, you three come out to the tent of meeting. Now at this time, before the tabernacle was fully built, there was a tent that where Moses and God would meet when Moses wasn't going up on the mountain. And when God wanted to meet, he would come in the Shekinah glory as cloud, and he would hover over the tent. And Moses would go up to the tent with whomever God asked for. Sometimes it was the elders, whatever. And when the cloud would come down over the tent, and everybody would come to the door of their tent, and they would watch the tent of meeting the whole time this meeting was going on. Now, if you read Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, you'll see that the way Israel was laid out was extraordinarily organized. There was the tabernacle, and there was three tribes on the east, three on the west, three on the north, three on the south. They were laid out by families, and when they got up to move, they moved in a certain order. All that's laid out. So these people would come to the tent, and they would watch. So Miriam and Aaron and Moses get called up to the tent of meeting for a meeting with God. And you can only figure that Miriam's thinking, well, now we're going to get this straight, we're going to get this fixed now. So the three of them came out, and then the Lord came down a pillar cloud. He stood at the doorway of the tent. He called out to Aaron and to Miriam. He said, and they both came forward. He said, now, hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I will speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly, not in dark sayings. And he beholds the form of God. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses? Oops. What possessed you that you were unafraid to speak against my servant Moses? Maybe you thought that I couldn't manage him, so you needed to? So the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he departed. But when the cloud had withdrawn over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous, as white as snow. As Aaron turned toward Miriam, behold, she was leprous. Now what happens is that Moses immediately goes on his face and begs God to take this away from her, because Moses always does. On three or four occasions, God says to Moses, I'm going to wipe everybody out and start over, get you a wife, and it'll take a long time, but we're going to start over. And, of course, God knows what he's going to do. But Moses always goes down on his face and says, God, don't do that. You're upset, don't do that. Moses is messianic, and he is willing to give up his life for the sake of his people. He says to him, take me, but don't do that to them. And then he says things like, if you do that, the Egyptians are going to laugh at you because they're going to say, you brought all these people out there and you couldn't manage it. That's what he says to him. God's going, hey, I like this guy. So he goes on his face and he begs God for Miriam. And God says, well, okay, since you ask, but it's not right that you get away with the scot-free. So for 30 days, she's going to be leprous. I mean, she has to move outside the camp and announce that she's unclean and all this kind of stuff. So all of Israel sat and waited for 30 days for Miriam to get over her leprosy, and then she got healed and whatever, and they went on. This story is a very fundamental story in my life, should be for all of us, I think. And that is that God has a mechanism for dealing with leaders. And it is the responsibility of the people to serve their leaders and let the mechanism God designed deal with it. So like in a church, for instance, there's a PPR committee. There's some group of people. There's a bishop. There's a district superintendent. And if someone wants to say to these people, we feel like there's a problem here, they need to do that and get on. They need to let those people deal with this pastor. When people in churches go out and decide they're going to deal with the pastor themselves, it always creates strife and all this other stuff. There is a process for dealing with bad presidents. It's called elections. And if we are pleasing to the Lord, he'll give us enough votes to deal with that. I have told you before about times in my life when I have had to report to people that I either didn't like or who I thought their judgment wasn't good. I didn't mean you. But I did, because, you know, I've told this story before. I was at a meeting at the Crown Plaza Hotel, and they decided they were going to reorganize the top upper leadership. And I was planning the meeting. I was getting everybody food and all this kind of stuff. And I had some time, so I went into the meeting, and they put a flow chart up on the thing up there. And on the flow chart, I suddenly looked, and all of a sudden, I was reporting to someone who had been my peer that very morning. Someone with whom I didn't particularly agree on how things ought to operate. And I looked at that, and I thought, what is that? And he turned around to me, and he said, did anybody tell you about this? I said, no. So, you know, I just went on, and things are bubbling, whatever. So I go, and I finished up the deal, and get my cookies and stuff, and the meeting's over. So that night, we've still got another day of the meeting. That night, I'm in my bedroom there at the hotel, and I'm steaming. I'm getting worse and worse, furious, furious. And finally, I sit down and I write a letter. I do this from time to time. It's almost always wrong. I sit down and I write a letter with my grievance, and I give it to my superior, which was Rand Ballard, who had been my superior. And it outlined all of the good and logical reasons why I shouldn't have to report to this particular guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so he says, well, gosh, Wayne, he said, I'm sorry, we should have told you about this. I guess we thought somebody else did. But he said, you know, let me think about whatever. So then that morning, I get called to a meeting. I'm in a meeting in the lobby of the Crown Plaza with my boss, not my new boss, but my older boss, and the head of HR and the CEO of the company. And so he's going, okay, now tell us about this scenario here. And, you know, some of this stuff sounds like maybe there's a problem here or whatever. We should know about this. So after a while, I go through all of this, and I'm beginning to emote about this. And so my CEO says to me, at this point in time, rather stridently, Wayne, you're acting like a child, and you need to straighten this out before you go hurt yourself. And he gets up and he walks off. So now I'm really pissed. So I go and I pass out cookies and everybody and get everybody out and get the rooms cleared out. And I go home, and it's Friday night. And so Friday night and all day Saturday, I am fuming, and I'm stomping around my office, and I've got the door shut, and I'm calling down fire on everybody. And, you know, I'm this isn't right, God, and whatever, and what am I going to do about it? And, yeah, I can quit, but then what am I going to do? Work for $2 an hour or something? I mean, all this stuff's going on. So finally, after I spin myself out, which is where we get to eventually, sooner than later is better, but I do, then I'm sitting down, and I'm quiet, and I'm listening to the Lord, and the Lord's beginning to tell me that, you know, it's God who organizes this and organizes that, and it is He who wants me to report to this person, and it's good for me in lots of ways, and I need to do this, and I need to submit myself, and I'm not going to always get the way that I want, and whatever. Anyway, it comes to me very clearly that this is the hand of God. He wants me to report to this person, and that the way I've behaved is bad. So now, on Monday morning, I get to go in and eat crow. So I'm writing another letter and telling everybody about it. You know, and I go to the guy who I was going to have to report to now, and I have to fess up to him what all happened. And he's a very professional man. Now, he's irritated at first because I acted this way, but he's very professional. So he says, okay, let's go on from here and whatever. So I've been with him for 2 years. And for the next 18 months, it kind of goes like this. He has this notion that the company ought to work in a certain way, and that it's his job to fix the company so it goes that way. Now, where he came from, the company was sort of organized by marketing, and sales reported to marketing. But in our company, in every company I've ever been associated with, it was organized by sales, and marketing reports to sales. And so he thought he should get that fixed. So we got these meetings coming up, and I'm working on these meetings, and they're now under him. And in times past, whenever these meetings would come up, he and I would always kind of bump heads about how we were going to do things. Now he's got the stick. So he says, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And so my job is to do what he tells me to do. So I say, well, you know, I don't think that's going to work, and this is why, but if that's what you want to do. So I'm committing my man hours, and whatever, to do all this kind of stuff, and we're organizing in a way that I know for sure is not going to work. So what happens is, eventually, the CEO comes and he says, what are we going to do about this or this? And I go, well, we're going to do it this way. And he goes, well, that's nuts. Why are we going to do it that way? And I said, well, you know, the boss, you know, wants me to do it that way. He said, well, go tell him not going to do it that way. I said, no, you go tell him we're not going to do it that way because you report to him. So he said, well, I'll speak to him. So for 18 months, this went on like this. And then finally, my new boss, he said, I give up. He said, I give up. So from that point on, for the next 6 months, he says, Wayne, what do you think we ought to do about this? What do you think we ought to do? And we had a great relationship for 6 months. And it was working good. He was inviting my input. It was just flowing really nice. And then he got promoted. But that experience was something God designed for me. He wanted me to submit to this person, even though I could see that things weren't, I mean, it wasn't like immorally right, wrong, but he wanted me to submit to this person and to learn to do the best I could and be obedient and do it with a good attitude. All these things were important for me to learn how to be obedient to God. This is one of many life experiences that I've had that God used in this regard. And so we have this thing with Miriam and Aaron, and we have this thing with David and, oh, I'm gone long, I'm so sorry. David and the king. I need to read this section just to finish this and then I'll quit. 1 Samuel 24. It came about when David had finished speaking these words to Saul. Remember, he had said to Saul, I could have killed you, but I didn't, and everything. Saul said, is this your voice, my son David? And then Saul lifted up his voice and he wept. And he said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have dealt well with me, while I have dealt wickedly with you. And you have declared today that you have done good to me, and that the Lord delivered me into your hand, and yet you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? May the Lord therefore reward you with good in return for what you have done to me this day. And now behold, I know that you shall surely be king, that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. So swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me. You will not destroy my name from my father's household. And David swore to Saul, and Saul went to his home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. And this lasted for a while. And we'll have another trip around the mountain. So, you know, this is not like us fighting Hitler, Ed. It's not like us fighting Hitler. This was him relating to his delegated authority from God. He trusted God to deal with that issue. If God was going to deal with him, it wasn't going to be by his hand. Alrighty, so my prayer is out. Sorry I went long.